Well, we're back in Mark 5. We're going to pick up at Mark chapter 5, verse 21 through 43. And just to remind us where we were last time, because we've been on a little bit of a break here for a second. The last time that we were in Mark, we were at the beginning of chapter 5. Jesus had just crossed the Sea of Galilee. No big deal. Definitely no problems with that one. Smooth, easy cruising. And once he was done talking to the water, they get to the other side. And he hops out of the boat and immediately comes running this demoniac man. And we read about him and how he was possessed by this legion of demons. And not only did Jesus show us power over the wind and the waves, he now has power over armies of demons. And now here, we're picking up with a new story. And so I'm going to read for us in Mark 21 through 43. I'm going to read the whole thing, and then we'll kind of come back around and we'll jump into it. Today we are going to look at a story of these two miracles. There's one sandwiched within the other, and I think we're going to see a lot of parallels within them. We'll try to kind of come back around at the end and point those out. I think it maybe is interesting for us to know that there's 61 accounts of Jesus healing somebody in the Gospels. Now, obviously, some of those are, repeated. But yeah, we've got 61 different accounts across the four Gospels of healings. And there's some that are unique. There's two unique to Matthew. And there are five that are unique in Luke and five unique in John. We talked about with Mark how everything in Mark is in Matthew and Luke. So there's none that are unique just to Mark. And so, with that said, let's jump in. Let's read 21 through 43, and then we'll begin to discover what's there for us in the Word. So, verse 21. And when Jesus had again crossed in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I even touch his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear. Only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. So there's our story today. Let's hop back to the beginning and let's begin to see what's there for us. So like we said, when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him and he was beside the sea. Now, like we said, Jesus had gone from one side of the Sea of Galilee. He had gone over to the other side. We looked at where that was, where the demoniac man was. We talked about how that was kind of Gentile country over there, not an area that he frequents at all. And now he's going back to the other side. And so as we're looking at it, back to the other side, based on kind of what we're reading, likely means right around Capernaum. That's where Jesus spends a lot of his time. And that kind of seems to be where this is all happening. So Jesus heads back over where he spends a lot of time. And notice, a great crowd gathered about him. The people heard about that he was coming, and they gathered back up. And so seemingly, it says, and he was beside the sea there at the end of 21. Seemingly, Jesus is kind of doing what we've been reading about. He's by the sea, kind of right on the seashore out on his boat, and he's talking and teaching to this big crowd that's out in front of him. Perhaps maybe he's not even on the boat. Perhaps it just says he was beside the sea. So perhaps he's kind of right off the boat, right on the seashore. But that's kind of what we're reading here. He's left this area on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. He's come back over to the northeastern side of the Sea of Galilee, where he spends the majority of the early portion of his ministry. And this is where he is. So that's kind of our setting. And it says in 22, then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. Again, we kind of said the assumption is that this is right in, if not actually in, Capernaum. And some of the things that we've already seen, and even some of the things maybe that aren't in Mark but are exclusive to Matthew or Luke that we know about, are happening in and around Capernaum. So Jairus, who's the ruler of the synagogue, now just to kind of understand that, he's not necessarily the teacher. He's not the one who's teaching. He's kind of the administrator, or one of the administrators overseeing the synagogue. So, you know, he's not exactly, again, he's not the rabbi who's unrolling the scroll and teaching. That's why rabbi means teacher. But he's the one who's picking and choosing who's coming in. He's the one who's accepting what they're having to say. He's the one who's overseeing the administration of, you know, the taxes and the offerings that are being collected. So he's not exactly a priest or a teacher himself, but more so an administrator. Still, if you are the leader, if you're the administrator, you know, think like a president of a university, right? Like, not necessarily the one teaching the class, not even necessarily the dean who's, you know, kind of working in and around and leading the teachers in that specific college, but even the one over them, the administrator who's kind of seeing this all play out and making it work. Well, the president of a university is a pretty prestigious position. So is the leader of a synagogue, at least in your own town. Sure, if you leave Capernaum and you roll down to Hebron, and you roll into Hebron, your clout is going to be way less important there because you're not the leader of their synagogue. You're the leader of your synagogue way up there. But in your town, boy, you've got a lot of influence. People definitely know who you are. And so here comes Jairus, one of the leaders of the synagogue, and he comes falling before the feet of Jesus. I mean, for us, like, think about what we already know. For example, we could look back at Mark 3:6. And we could see in Mark 3:6 where the Pharisees are already, I'll just read it for us. It says, the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him being Jesus, how to destroy him being Jesus. So we can already see that the ruling class, the people who are leading the Jewish faith, they're already riled up with Jesus in this area. This is where he's doing work. They already are out seeking to destroy him. So for Jairus to come before Jesus, for Jairus to come and to beg of Jesus, he is risking a lot. People are going to see him and know, hey, there's Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue. And he's coming before Jesus and asking for help. That's not going to be ignored. People are going to talk about that. And we don't know specifically exactly how everybody in the area feels, but like we read in Mark 3:6, we know the rulers, the people who he's rubbing elbows with, they're not fond of Jesus. The opposite. They're seeking to destroy him. So Jairus is laying it on the line here to come and fall before Jesus. And also remember what we've talked about falling at the feet. That's not just a small act. That's not just nothing for the Jewish person. To fall down at your face before the feet of someone is a big thing. Dare I say worship? And so for Jairus, everything that we're seeing right here leads us to say that this man believes truly in who Jesus is and what he's doing. He may not have, no human at this point has a full understanding of what Jesus is and who he is. But what we can see is that this man believes that guy can do something for me that no one else can. I have no other option, and I'm going to risk everything to fall down at my face before him. And I'm going to beg him to come. I mean, she's not just sick. Like, if you recall our introduction to Mark, and it's online if you'd like to listen to it, we talked about how Mark borrows some things from, you know, like we would kind of say like colloquialisms, right? Like sayings. We might say, oh yeah, they're on death's doorstep. They're real. It's a tough one for them. And so Mark is borrowing a Romanism, a Latinism, a saying for the Roman people here when he says she is at the point of death. That's like them saying death's doorstep. We kind of know what that means and what it implies. She's literally at the point of death, one step further and death. So he's not coming to her saying, oh, she's sick and like real sick. No, she's going to die any second. He trusts in Jesus so much he's willing to potentially miss, and he does, his daughter's last breath in the hopes that maybe Jesus can get there. The last thing to point out, and this is just kind of showing us about who Jairus is and the weight of it, is notice what we read, right? That a great crowd had gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. So sea, great crowd. But then it says, then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet. So Jairus somehow gets close enough to Jesus. And I want us to think about this. He gets through a great crowd to be able to come right up to Jesus' feet and fall before him. People who have been waiting by the oceanside just to get close to Jesus, so when he shows up by boat, they might be the closest ones. Jairus is able to just kind of come right on through and fall down at Jesus' feet. That's influence. Hold on to that, because we're going to kind of see a mirror of that in just a minute. The last thing that we kind of want to hold on to is we notice that, hey, we've seen, okay, here's Jairus. He's come. He's got Jesus' attention. He's fallen down and thrown himself before Jesus. He's risked it all, and Jesus is going to go with him. There's plenty of people, I'm sure, in that crowd that have been begging for help. Jesus has gained this following for the healings and the miracles that he's done. Got a feeling Jairus wasn't the first person in the crowd to beg, but there was something about him that caused Jesus to leave this situation and go and follow him. So he does. It says, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. So again, here's this great crowd, and now it's coming with him. This goes along with what we know. And we don't use the word thronged very much today. That's maybe a word that we're not thinking about. But I mean, we can imagine it's this crowd that's pressing in and it's moving and it's flowing. Like if we've ever seen I guess even before drones today, there was blimps that were overlooking at like sporting events and stuff. But if we've ever seen big crowds at a concert or a sporting event or something where there's tens of thousands of people, you can almost see it. It almost looks like a moving organism in a sense. It's kind of moving and waving, and that's what this crowd is doing. It's following around Jesus, and it's almost like that living kind of organism that's sucking in around him, trying to move through tight city streets with him. So that's what's happening here. And I'm going to read a couple verses in a row here now for us. I'll read 25 through 26. It says, there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, but was no better and rather grew worse. Now, before we really dive into some of the nitty gritty of this, I just want to say that this is a little funny to me. When Luke records this, you know, Luke, who's considered to be a physician, Mark says she had suffered much under many physicians and she had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. Luke says she's incurable. So, Luke wanted no blame on that one. I just think that's a little funny. Anyway, so looking at this here, so here's a woman who had discharged blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians, spent all that she had, but was no better, rather growing worse. She's been closed out of her life entirely. Let me turn for us for a second here to Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 15. The whole chapter is kind of talking about, this whole section of Leviticus, like 14 through 20-ish, is talking about being unclean and becoming clean and things like that. But then 15 specifically is talking about just bodily fluids is probably the most polite way to say it all in general, and things that can make you clean and unclean. And then we're going to read 25 through 31 because this specifically is going to help us understand the plight of this woman beyond just her literal physical problem. So Leviticus 15, starting in verse 25. If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, menstrual impurity, or if she has discharge beyond the time of her impurity, all the days of the discharge she shall continue in uncleanliness. As the days of her impurity, she shall be unclean. Every bed on which she lies all the days of her discharge shall be to her as the bed of impurity. And everything on which she sits shall be unclean, as in the uncleanliness of her impurity. And whoever touches these things shall be unclean, and shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. But if she is cleansed of her discharge, she shall count herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. And on the eighth day she shall take two turtle doves or two pigeons and bring them to the priest, to the entrance of the tent of the meeting. And the priest shall use one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for her before the Lord for her unclean discharge. Thus you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanliness, lest they die in their uncleanliness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst. So that is the section in Leviticus where we can read why this woman specifically is unclean.
Praise God, we don't live under that anymore.
Amen. Yep. Also, what she's got going on today, simple surgery. You're in and out on the same day, you're taken care of. Just not the case for her in this time. But for her in this time, that's what she's living under. For 12 years. For 12 years, she can't go to the temple. She's unclean. For 12 years, she can't enter the marketplace with everybody else. She's unclean. For 12 years, she can't walk to the wells with the other women. She's unclean. She has spent everything and tried everything to find a cure. She has suffered, and it's not even like stagnating. It's just getting worse. Everything about this woman, society looks at and says, "You're unclean, don't come near me." I mean, she's at absolute worst, she's risking having to come into the middle of this crowd, touching everybody, and she's going to have to wash everyone's clothes. They're all going to be unclean to the end of the day. That's just by the law. We can think about what people do out of irrationality. And just imagine you're a person who just found out you were touched by this unclean woman and now all of a sudden you're unclean. You think maybe in a great crowd of like that, somebody might lose control of their anger and flip out? I mean, this woman is risking her life coming into this crowd the way that she is. The condition she's in. Again, we're not talking about New York City with millions and millions of people where you can kind of be a ghost and no one knows your name and face. A little bit smaller of a crowd and a little bit smaller of a town. People know who she is after 12 years of uncleanliness. And she comes right into the middle of the crowd. It says in 27, she had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garments. For she said, "If I even touch his garments, I will be made well." She doesn't get to have a crowd clear that she can come right through. She squeezes and presses in through this crowd. That if I could even just get close enough to touch his garment, I will be made well. If you've been with us in our Acts study, we've kind of looked at this, how not just Jewish people, but ancient people in general kind of held the superstition that, well, if you were a blessed or a special person who was doing these great things, then the parts about you were also blessed and special. So if I could even touch your clothes, well, your clothes are on you, and so they are also blessed. If I can even be touching your shadow, we read in Acts, then I might be healed. So it's just kind of the superstition of the time that, man, if I can even just get close enough to just be in his general region, that might be enough for me. So here is this woman risking it all to just get close to Jesus, because That would be enough. It says in 29, and immediately the flow of blood dried up and she felt her body was healed of her disease. Notice this. At this moment, the second she touches the clothes, she immediately feels that her illness is done and she is physically healed, right? That's what it says. Immediately, this moment, she's physically healed. But wait. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who'd done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him. And she told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." We'll go back and look at a couple other things, but I just want to point out that Jesus didn't stop right there. She was healed. She knew it. He knew it. He could have just let her carry on. Why not? She's healed, right? No, there's more, because the healing wasn't done yet. It wasn't just enough for her to be physically healed of her ailment. There had to be more. This word, 34, your faith has made you well, you've been healed. The word that we actually see there, the Greek, is this word sozo. Now, 93 times in the Bible, we see this word used as one thing, and only 14 times do we see it used as made well or made whole. The 93 times we see it used as save. Let me give you some examples. And the first one, kind of famous here. Let me turn to John for us. John 3. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his son in order to come into the world to condemn the world, but in order that he might be saved through him." Same word. Same word that we're saying to this woman, that you might be healed, that you might be whole, is the same word here used in John 3:17, that the world might be saved through him. I don't think he's just talking about physical healing there, though. Let's look at some other examples. Luke. In Luke 17, he heals 10 lepers. And then he said to them, "Rise, go your way. Your faith has made you well." That seems a whole lot like what I just heard, isn't it? How about one more, later on in Mark. We'll get to this in a couple weeks. In Mark 10, once again, Jesus healing a blind man. And Jesus said to him, "Go your way. Your faith has made you well." And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. Same word. What we can see, and we can run this down again, 93 times, we can run down the word sozo and see what it means when it means to be saved. And yet here, three times when he's healing someone of a physical ailment, he's using that same word that he uses in John 3:17. That you're made whole. You're made well. Jesus didn't stop and call this woman out. He wasn't asking. He knew. "No, woman, the one who touched me, that's an invitation for you to come forth." And she comes forth so she might receive the fullness of what he has to offer. Not just the physical healing, but the fullness of it. How many people are in the crowd with arthritis, with a cough, with a bum knee? I bet they were touching Jesus too. Did power leave him in that moment? No, it's her faith running him down to be healed of her physical ailment that allows him to say, "No, I see who you are and what your heart is." And he stops so that she can receive the full healing that he has to offer. And the last thing that I want to point out in this is, and this really could be the whole sermon. It's not the heartbeat of where we're driving, but in a different place that has different people and has different needs, this might be the focus of today. Remember the state of this little girl? She's at the point of death. They're having to fight through a crowd to get wherever Jairus is taking them. This is a life or death situation. This is Jesus himself following through on the mission that he has from God. I feel like we can all agree that qualifies as important. That's important work, life and death. He stops. He takes time and he stops for this woman. There's not one of us in our life who is so busy that we can't take time to stop for somebody. That when there's a need presented in front of us and that the Lord is moving in our heart, that we can't stop and pause. Even when it's important work, life and death situation, Jesus still took the time to stop. So I'm not going to linger there too long, but I do want to point it out. I do want us that to be in our mind that, look, we aren't Jesus. Usually we're not on a life and death mission. And so often, can't do that right now, pretty busy. So let us see this example of Christ and follow in it. But to turn back here, to turn back to the focus of where we really are trying to be today. He stops for this woman. He gives her the fullness of the blessing, not just healing her physically. And then he sends her on her way. We'll come back at the end here and look at this woman just a little bit more. But for now, I want us to carry on and get back here to Jairus and his daughter. To do that, just to read 34, he said, Jesus, and he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Two things. One is interesting. That's the only time Jesus calls somebody daughter. Don't have really a whole lot more to say to you, but what we can see is that she's brought into the family. Why she's the only one, don't know, but she is one. And imagine being Jairus in that moment. Your daughter is on the brink of death, and here we are holding up for this one. To hear daughter, not that he'd be envious or hateful towards this woman in his heart, but the knife that must have been. He needs his daughter to be well. It says in 35, while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? The people that come up to Jairus at this point, hey, she's done. This Jesus guy, sure, he's been healing the paralyzed and been taking away the demons from the possessed, but she's dead. It's time to move on. Come back and grieve. But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. So here now we're leaving this great crowd. Jairus, Jesus, and the big three, the inner three, go along. They show up to the house. And when they come to the house, they see this great commotion. We know that the Jewish people, they'd hire professional mourners to come. That even if you were the poorest of the poor, you needed to have at least one flute and one wailing woman. So for Jairus, who's the ruler of the synagogue, I mean, just imagine the circus that's out here in front of the house. So Jesus sees all of this, and when he entered, he says, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child's not dead, but sleeping. Thanks for the rhyme, Dr. Seuss. It says, look, Jesus isn't confused. He's not wrong. She is dead. But to the author of all creation, who holds all of life in his hands, what is physical death but a nap? Yeah, to you, she's dead. For me, she's asleep. What are you worried about? It says, and they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. So we've got seven people in the room. Jairus, his daughter, Jairus, his wife, Jesus, and the three apostles that are with him. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi, which means little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. He is the master of illness. He is the master of the nature. He is the master of the demons. Now he's even the master of life and death. This is the first time that it's recorded, at least, that Jesus does something like this. We later see it with Lazarus. We later see it himself. But this is seemingly the first time. And again, he doesn't need rituals. He doesn't need to set up this grand performance. He says, little girl, get up. And immediately she does. He doesn't need time to heat in the oven and for something to come around. No, no. Here's this girl that everyone knows is dead. And he just says, up now. Time to go. And he charged them that no one would know this and to give her something to eat. Once more, we see that, hey, look, there's going to be a time and a place to share, but this isn't it. They're already after me. We've already got commotion. Don't let this get out. Just give your daughter something to eat. I want to point out here, as we're going to begin to look at some of these similarities, notice how old she is. She's 12. And notice how long the lady suffered with her bleeding. For 12 years. There's a lot of other parallels that we can see in here. We can see that here comes both Jairus and this woman falling at the feet of Jesus. Here comes them fully surrendering to whatever may happen in their lives. Whatever the consequences are. Here they come full of faith that Jesus is the one hope that I have. There's so much mirrored here, and yet they're from full opposite ends of life. An unclean woman who is ostracized from society, and a man who's the leader in society. One who the crowds open up for so that he could walk through up to Jesus, and one who has to press through the throng. That number 12, I don't think it's a total coincidence that that's the number chosen. The number 12 is highly representative in Scripture of several things. But one of those most central things is the completeness and the authority of God. There's a lot of examples out there, right? 12 apostles, 12 tribes. Here's one, though, from the end of days. We can look to Revelation and see that, again, thinking about the fullness of what God has, the completeness of what he has, and his sovereign power. Turning to Revelation 21 and in 22 as well. I'm going to read a couple verses for us here. This is in the new heaven and the new earth, the final creation, the full fulfillment of what God has. Beginning in 21, beginning in verse 10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of the heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels. And on the gates, the names of 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. And the one who had spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. The city lies four square, its length the same at each width. And he measured the city with his rod, 12,000 stadia. Its length and width and height are equal. He also measured its wall, 144 cubits, which is, you guessed it, 12 by 12. To hop over to 22, beginning in verse 1, 1 and 2. Then the angel showed me the river of water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the city, street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life with 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the trees were for healing of the nations. So again, 12 is this number that should bring our minds to this full, complete power and authority of God. And what are we talking about here? That he has full, complete authority over everything. He heals the sick. He stops the winds and the waves. He unpossesses the demons from the men. And now even life and death, he is sovereign and complete over. When he wants something done, it's done. Immediately. Across the whole spectrum. So for us, as we're beginning to wrap up here now, and kind of just having some concluding thoughts, we're looking at some of these parallels, and we're understanding that for us, that any single one of us falls under this divine, sovereign authority of God, complete authority of God. We can see, no matter who we are, the ruler over here, or the ostracized woman over here, or somewhere in the middle, Jesus is for us, our ruler, our leader. And if that's true, then we can see what we've seen in this story, that he came for us. And he came not just to take care of the physical, but also the spiritual. For example, we can see back just a little bit ago in Mark 2, with the paralyzed man lowered in through the roof, something Jairus himself might have seen. We can read 2:9-12 that say, which is easier to say to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven? Or to say, rise, take up your bed and walk. But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. He said to the paralytic, I say to you, rise, pick up your bed and go home. And he rose and immediately picked up his bed. And he went out before all of them so that they were all amazed, glorified God, saying, we never saw anything like this. Or we could go to Matthew. We could read in Matthew where he says, this is in Matthew chapter 13, and he's quoting back earlier to the Old Testament, but it says, for this the people's heart has grown dull, and with their eyes they can barely hear, and their eyes have closed, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and turn, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. Again, Jesus saying, if you would just turn to me, that I would heal you. And we can see that what he says here, healing, is so much more than just the physical. I hope that, you know, as we're considering this, that, look, Jesus has come for us. That we could consider the people and the way that they came, that they boldly came to Christ. That they fell down before him, full of faith. And that for us, like we've been saying, that that's for all of us. In Galatians in 28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. And so this is us, all of us, able to be brought into the promise, that we might have a hope and a future in Jesus. Then in Hebrews 4:16, that we can read and know, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. Folks, for us, we have to consider ourselves like this woman, like Jairus, that we would come before Jesus and we would throw ourselves at his feet, full of faith, full of confidence, that he might sustain us, that he might give us what we need. We can look and see and know that he has power over all of his creation. There is nothing that he does not control fully. That we can draw near to him, draw near to his sweet, gentle, good nature, and find rest and find hope. That there is nothing in this world that he cannot control, that he can heal us physically and spiritually. We can look in the Bible and see that every man but Jesus, and I suppose Elijah too, has met an ultimate end. James, one of the three who got brought up to that room, was the first of the apostles martyred quickly in Acts. It's not when we read this that we promise that we're going to be never in the hospital. We just heard our prayer list. But what we can do is we can see that Jesus is good to be our healer in more ways than one. That lady, the second she touched him, like we read, immediately left her. And yet Jesus stopped because she had more for her. He heals us in a greater way than one. And we can have full confidence that all of us can come to him for that. All of us can come to be made whole. To be made whole. And it's him who does it. Let us pray.